Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. For a free 30-day trial to Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
The stars at night are big and bright, deep in the heart of Texas.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a new classic review episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me today we have Michael Snydell.
Howdy.
Bill Graham.
Woo!
And we have a special guest here today to talk our classic movie review of Paris, Texas by Wim Wenders, and that is Clint Worthington.
Oh, hello.
Oh, hello, Clint. How are you today?
Good. I'm wearing my dusty suit and MAGA hat in honor
of
this occasion.
You got your red baseball cap on.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell the folks at home a little about yourself so they learn, as we have, to trust you as an expert on cinema.
Sure. Well, I'm a Scorpio. I love long walks on the beach or along the Arizona flats. But more pertinent to your question, I'm a film critic for Consequence of Sound, and I'm also the co-host of now three podcasts. I'm pretty sure I'm going to go insane by the end of the year. First, Alcohollywood, where we talk about a different movie every week and make a custom cocktail and a drinking game for it. I'm also the co-host of Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast. And just this week, I started with my fellow COSer, Allison Shoemaker, who's also been a guest on your show, TV Party.
Yeah, TV Party.
It's our official TV podcast for Consequence of Sound. So the first episode is dropped now, and we're dropping everything. We're dropping all the singles be dropping. That's pretty much what I do.
What are y'all covering right now?
Let's see. The first episode we did, we talked about the Good Place finale. And
Damn it. Okay.
Oh, I haven't seen
the finale. I need to watch that fucking thing.
Right. I know, you got to. And then we talked about how we hoped we were going to find out how Jack dies in This Is Us in the Super Bowl episode. So now that we know, we can follow up on that.
Spoiling all sorts of shit.
We've known he was going to die. We just don't know how.
Well, we had this conversation.
That's the premise of the show.
In our last episode, we just talked for an inordinately long time about this character on a show that none of us watched dying. And we're saying, like, is this a spoiler? And it's like, I don't know. I don't even watch the show.
Yeah. All you need to know is that every single second of This Is Us, and I like This Is Us, is scored like a dog food commercial. It's that sort of treacly acoustic guitar sentiment, yeah.
Oh, so not like one of the happy dog food commercials.
No, like one of the earnest dog food commercials about like the dog who's, you know, like 15 years old and is on his last legs. But God bless him. You just want to make sure he gets the nutrition he needs.
Right. There's that. Oh, that one commercial with the little girl who's like five and she's like, come on, Max. And then like it shows them growing up together and he's still as strong because he's eating Iams with like joint health. Yeah.
And the dog dies.
They don't show.
They show you. They tell you in the opening minutes the dog doesn't die, but they won't show you how yet.
This is.
You just know it's sad.
This is a weird thing. I don't know if anyone here has children. When my wife told me she was pregnant, the third thought that I had was, "Oh my God, my daughter's going to be 10 when my dogs die." I immediately started doing calculations that far in advance, and I was like, like, heaven help me if she's like 7 and I have to explain mortality to her. I feel like by 10 she should pretty much have figured it out.
Wait, she figured it out by 10? Can she explain it to me then?
I mean, when she becomes 10 in 8 years, maybe. We'll see about that, Michael.
Watch Homeward Bound, you'll understand.
Okay. Well, none of them die there.
Well,
that movie
pussies
out. Let's be real.
Yeah. Oh.
Shadow should have aided in that hole. Anyway, so you're here to help us talk about Paris, Texas, which is the 1984 film from Wim Wenders. Do you have like a special connection to this film? That's one of the reasons you're here, or is this just fun?
I just like it a lot. I mean, I've written about it before, just like a few years back. There was a sort of like a blog round robin where myself and a bunch of other blogs talked about a different movie from 1984, and I picked it. And I'm also a huge Criterion nerd, so I've had the Blu-ray for a while. I've watched it a bunch of times, and I did fall in love with the movie. And I keep thinking of it as we all have Letterboxd accounts here, right? And you have to pick your like top four films, and there's a lot of pressure to figure out what those are going to be. But I knew that I wanted to put Paris, Texas on there because it is a movie that I genuinely love and I do really like. But I also knew how smart it would seem that I put it on there. So that's why I'm here.
Yeah, it's a lot better than mine where it's like The Thin Red Line, Shoot 'Em Up, 13 Zemetti, and I think The Page Turner, which is a French film that no one's ever heard of.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Well,
we
good
have,
for
like,
you.
We should just have an entire podcast where we do nothing but talk about our Letterboxd top picks.
Yeah.
I'm good with that.
That would be super strange. Anyway.
You're welcome for that one.
So let's rush through all the stuff we usually got to talk about up front. Twitter, at Film Stage Show, Facebook, The Film Stage Show. Find us on iTunes, comment, rating. Go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow to give $1 per episode and help us to produce these classic episodes. These classic episodes are only brought to you because you hit one of our thresholds. And if you keep giving us more money, we will keep carving precious hours out of our lives to keep producing extra episodes just for you. You also get access to our Slack channel, where today we spent close to an hour trying to figure out, I guess it's a spoiler, the Cloverfield paradox.
We are trying to figure out how big a certain
thing in the movie is, and it has been a study in madness.
I muted y'all within like 10 minutes.
Wow.
Oh, that's man. Great. Anyway, so
Michael is not here for our nerd.
I had the
bullshit.
Same discussion with Boogie Nights.
Mother.
Michael probably would have muted you too.
I'm probably. Not here for science. Are you kidding?
Okay, to call what we were doing science is an insult to science. But anyway, so do that. Patreon.com/filmstageshow. Also, don't forget that we, as always, are brought to you by MUBI, the online streaming cinema, where every day they release a new film and you have 30 days to watch. So you have a 30-day. You have a 30-film rotating collection of films you can watch. Some of the best independent world and all-around great cinema. You can download it to your phone if you're a monster and want to watch a movie on your phone. You can download it to your laptop, watch it on the go. You can use your smart TV or your Google Fire Stick or Roku Stick or anything like that. It's got one of the best video streaming apps out there, which is great because I can't tell, again, the abyss of Netflix. You go on, you tend to watch a movie, and instead 3 hours later you realize that you've watched most of a season of Frasier.
R.I.P.D. John Mahoney. Mahoney?
I know.
Mahoney.
Yeah. Mahoney.
I keep confusing John Mahoney and John Mulaney, which is probably a mistake on my part.
I'm sure that Mulaney would feel pretty good about that, though.
I think Mahoney was younger at heart.
So when I told my wife, because we literally did just randomly start rewatching Frasier, I told my wife, you know, that he'd passed, and she's like, oh my God. And I said, he was only 77. She's like, that's crazy. He, you know, they must have aged him up for that. And then I said, wait a second, how old is Kelsey Grammer? They're only 15 years apart. And they play father and son in that show. So,
I mean, it's possible.
Think about that. Yeah, you think that's canon? You think that they had him have Frasier as a 15-year-old?
They were prepping that for the prequel.
Of course. Like, what was the age difference between
young Frasier?
The Frasier paradox.
Oh, God. Oh, anyway, this is still a movie plug. So go to MUBI.com/filmstage for a free 30-day trial of MUBI. So that you can experience how great this particular streaming service is. Again,
isn't that the streaming service that only shows Dogma?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Okay. Just want to make sure.
It's the golden calf of streaming services. MUBI.com/filmstage.
I'm just trying to help you out.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Now I've got an image of Buddy Jesus in my head. So. Mm-hmm. As I said, we're here today to talk about Paris, Texas. It's all we're going to talk about. There will be no spoiler section. This is a classic film review. We expect that you've either seen it or you're not going to jump down our throats if we spoil a movie that is 33 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So let's talk about it. Let's let our guest go first. Why don't you give us your kind of capsule thoughts on Paris, Texas? Why is this a movie you love so much? So much so that it's in your Letterboxd top five.
Sure. So, Paris, Texas, like you said, directed by Wim Wenders, who's one of my very favorite filmmakers. And also, it's a wonderful performance by Harry Dean Stanton, one of our greatest formerly living actors. But it's such an iconic role. I thought I was going to say that, and I'm like, that's not accurate.
Formerly living.
He's
best if he
dead.
Was still alive, but now that he's entered the land of the dead, he's yes. up there amongst dead actors.
Yeah. Right. One of the greatest dead actors of our time. Well, it's such an iconic role that his last, what ended up being his last film, Lucky, kind of feels essentially like a spiritual sequel to this a little bit, where it's this melding of sort of new Western iconography. And what it is, it's essentially a family drama dressed up as a road movie with a lot of like Western thematic imagery to it. And so it's all, for me, it's all about the craftsmanship. Wim Wenders' direction is outstanding. Sam Shepard has this beautifully lyrical, theatrical script. I mean, I think it's effectively based off of one of his short stories, I think, like the Motel Chronicles or something like that. But and just a bevy of wonderful performances from both like veteran actors like Harry Dean Stanton and Dean Stockwell, but even the kid Hunter Carson gives a little like fun precocious performance, and he hits those emotional beats as well. So it's, you know, it's a long film at 2.5 hours, but it hits that wonderful sort of melancholic emotional tone that really hits me to the core when I'm, you know, when I'm paying attention to movies. And yeah, I just really, really love it.
All right. Michael Snydell, what about you?
Yeah, you know, Paris, Texas was my, I have to admit, it's my first Wenders experience. I've seen it twice now in the past about 6 months. And I think it's, you know, it's a film I'm still honestly puzzling over, in the sense that it is in some way, as Clint was kind of mentioning, like it is a, you know, a family story wrapped up in a road movie. But there's also something a lot more, I feel like that's almost too traditional of a description, even mm-hmm. to basically describe it. Because there is something at once very direct in its pacing, which I absolutely think comes from Wenders, like, understanding how to direct these actors. But there's also something very, very like almost obtuse in what it wants to say about, you know, family histories and like the way mistakes linger. And even to the point where the main character at times almost seems to have as much in common with, you know, like a fish out of water alien story as, you know, a traditional, you know, family story of a father who hasn't been around. Like, there's something that isn't quite quirky, but deeply strange and distant about Harry Dean Stanton's role in this, which feels almost ageless and ancient. And it's that role, especially, that I think makes this film just kind of more and more strange the more I think about it. I mean, as far as a film, I mean, I think it's pretty fantastic. But again, I feel like it's almost too easy to do a straight reading of it. And that, I think that as much comes from the performances as it being almost a European vision of Americana.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree with you. I mean, I agree that my reading is pretty, it's not even really my reading, but my description was pretty straightforward and traditional. But I agree that there is this lyricism to it that is really, really fascinating, especially when, like you said, when applied to these straightforward American things. I mean, even you're introduced to that international spirit from the beginning, you know, with the German guy who picks him up and Dean Stockwell's French wife. Like, these are not the types of characters you typically see in the Old West, you know? These are not, like, characters indicative of that. And even Natasha Kinski to a certain extent. But, yeah, no, I totally agree that there's something not lurking beneath the surface, but there is something heightened about this journey that he goes on. And I totally agree with you, the sort of alien presentation of him, especially in the beginning as he's wandering through the desert in that opening scene. He may as well have materialized out of thin air. It kind of reminds me of the beginning of The Man Who Fell from Earth.
Yeah, or Starman was specifically what I was thinking of when I made that comparison, but yeah.
Yeah, no. Right,
well, Bill Graham, what do you think of Paris, Texas?
I really enjoyed it. This is my second Wim Wenders movie. The other one was a documentary called Pina, this one's very different, obviously. But I'm surprised that Harry Dean Stanton didn't find more work as a leading man. And you know, there's a long tradition of like having the character actors finally have their kind of break. And I think it was Richard Jenkins recently that he had been playing a lot of character actors, and it wasn't until like The Visitor when he finally broke out. And I just find it fascinating that so many of these films revolve around a character actor that finally gets his break, and you just realize how much of a waste it was that they didn't get there sooner. And so I was struck by that by Harry Dean Stanton. He's doing some odd choices, and I think Wenders is part of that. Maybe the script as well. Michael's right. It feels very alien. He feels very kind of lost and kind of out of touch. I was almost expecting kind of an Encino Man, kind of like, here's what you do in this, and here's what you do with that. Like, you know, that's how out of touch he kind of seems at first. But I really enjoyed kind of the journey and figuring out what was going on with him. And I appreciated that the characters around him are all kind of simultaneously rooting for him, but also frustrated with him as much as I was, because we don't know his backstory and neither do the characters that he's interacting with. And so everybody's just kind of like, what is your deal? You know, and nobody keeps themselves from like saying that. I think his brother at one point like literally yells at him and is like, well, you gotta tell me. And you know, he just kind of clams up at that. He's just like, and then his brother's immediately just like, yeah, that's not gonna get us forward, is it? It's just like, nope, you yell at me, I just shut down. So I enjoyed it.
So I guess I'm going to be the not negative voice, but the least positive voice. I saw this movie a while ago, way back in the day, when I first started getting into film. And I was like, what are the films that I need to watch? And it was one of those summers where I would skip blithely from The Ratcatcher to Seven Samurai and then go to Straw Dogs. And then at some point I landed on Paris, Texas. And The one thing that I really remembered from this movie before doing my rewatch last week was that I was fairly certain that for the first hour, half of Dean Stockwell's dialogue was just saying Travis or Trav. Glad to know that I wasn't wrong about that. And if I never have to hear him say that name again, I'll be happy. As for the rest of it, nothing else really stuck with me. And rewatching it this time, I kind of felt that same tug of my memory trying to just get rid of this movie. It feels like it is evaporating as I watch it. And I don't know precisely why that is. This is the type of movie that feels like it would appeal to my sensibilities, dealing as it does with like the long-lasting psychological effects of tragedy and trying to make up for past wrongs and, you know, just basic American ennui nonsense. But there's just something about it that it doesn't play for me. I can't hold on to it. And looking at how long it is, thinking back on it, I don't know where that 2.5 hours went. Because when I replay everything in my head, there's not a whole lot of incident in this movie. And it feels as though it moves fairly quickly. So I'm lost. I feel like I've been, you know, to go back to our space metaphors, I feel like I was abducted by aliens and I'm suffering from lost time. And just going back over the scenes of the countryside and this man walking within it, and the hours of having to break his silence before he finally, you know, decides to take some action. I just never engaged with it. And it's funny because this movie ends in a way that I feel like it's the type of movie that, to use a really bad analogy, is like Gone Baby Gone, where you can, like, question the intelligence or the morality of the final choices made regarding the well-being of a child. But I'm not even really interested in that. Like, I just... the movie never engaged me in a way that it felt real enough to really care about the way that everyone ends up. So, minus.
You Philistine. All right.
I know. Monster. It's funny because I love Wings of Desire, and I've liked most of the other Vim... I was just going to call them Vim movies. Vim Vendors movies.
I was going to say, it's pronounced Wings of Desire.
Yes, that's true.
Vimmy V?
All W's are V's now.
Yeah, this movie just isn't a winner in my mind. And I,
oh, Jesus Christ.
And I don't
hit me through with the shit.
So I mean, this is going to be like the Phantom Thread, where I had like a muted reaction. I'm a little more negative on this one than I was on Phantom Thread. But I'm looking forward to hearing from you all just what exactly this movie did for you, so maybe I can understand how I'm dead inside.
Well, I guess it's kind of hard to address the criticisms because it is such a subjective thing. Because, you know, I think from how it sounds like, you know, you picked up on a lot of the same thematic stuff and a lot of the aesthetic stuff that I picked up on, but it just didn't engage you. But I will say that for me, I never really had the problem of a bunch of I can't remember what specific incidents were happening, because like I tend to have a similar, not problem, but that tends to happen with me too when I try to remember what happens in Paris, Texas. But it doesn't feel to me a movie about plot. It is very character centric. It's very theme centric. And I think because everything is sort of so static, and I mean not static per se, because it is a road movie and Harry Dean Stanton is always going towards something, but I don't know. There's just something very, because he's such a cipher and he goes on such a journey to like open up so much to, you know, where he's silent for a half hour all the way up to the end where he's offering these monologues. I just think there's something intrinsically fascinating about that journey and the lyricism of Shepherd's script and the direction that, I don't know. It's like looking at a really long, beautiful painting, like looking at American Gothic for 2.5 hours, I suppose.
I was going to say a long painting, someone that's like 20 feet long.
Yeah, yeah, really long. You have to like walk really slowly from one end to the other, yeah.
Yeah, like one of those Japanese screens.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
You know, I'm still trying to... Sorry, I just wanted to briefly talk about that... the sense of it being a road movie but it not being a traditional road movie in the sense right. that like even yeah. excuse me like even so the road movie, there's kind of two different road trips that take place over the course of this movie, kind of. The second one is sort of more traditional in the sense that like at least they are having he's having conversations with his son who, mm-hmm. you know, is not actually really talking to him though. Like he's talking about, you know, the Big Bang, or he's talking about things he learned at school, or, you know, doing bizarre plays on the, you know, if John is on the train going at 60 miles per hour, when is he going to get to, you know, whatever or how long will it take him to get to this destination at what miles per hour? Like there's something very, like it's interesting that you're talking about it evaporating as you're watching it. Cause I think I would also use that description with this film, but I'd use it in a positive way because I think there's something very interesting about the fact that, a lot of those road trip parts, and even when he finally is at his brother's house, a lot of those interactions seem to have this is transience the word I'm looking for? Yeah, like this...
like an ephemerality?
Yes, thank you, Clint. Yeah,
you're
like an ephemerality that then when we finally get to the emotional weight, which is still kind of couched in this ambiguity about whether that's exactly how it happened. Like, I think there's something that makes this really powerful, that there only really seem like two or three scenes in this movie that do actually have anything of significance or weight. But I feel like that is kind of perfect for this character, like someone who has been, you know, instead of like an alien metaphor, I'd almost say like he's been hibernating for 4 years. Like it's not like a certain part of human existence doesn't exist, but it's time, and his place in this world has become so scrambled and so lost at this point that it only makes sense that he can't really impact this world, even as the people around him, you know, want him to, you know, like assert his place, whether as a father or a brother or just a human being. Like his brother even saying, you know, like when he sees that Travis is shining shoes just because he can't sleep, he's like, I can get you a job at the airport. and it's everyone else is thinking in the long term, in like, what is my life going to be now that this person is back? But Travis like never seems to think that way. Like even when he goes off into the sunset, it honestly seems like he disappears into thin air.
Yeah, he's just gonna go back to the desert.
Yeah, because his character just kind of, I mean, throughout the film his character feels as light as air. I mean, I think, you know, he's, there's again, there's something alien and distanced about him, and it's really helped by Stanton's performance, which is just so fragile and delicate, and actually I think it works especially in the film's favor when you get those final scenes when they're talking to each other through the one-way mirror and giving their monologues, and he's telling the story of this man who is very clearly him, and he talks about this mean streak that he used to have, and it's such a startling sort of revelation when you see the movie, when you see the character that we've seen throughout the movie, this very gentle guy, this very unassuming man who isn't crawling back demanding his son back. He goes and lives with his brother for a while and sort of just slowly ingratiates himself back to his son because he understands this wrong that he's committed, and he is deathly dedicated to rectifying those wrongs and getting back into his family's good graces, so to speak. So I think the fact that, you know, Stockwell's character feels, if I were to put it uncharitably, insubstantial, it actually works in the film's favor. I mean, it sort of makes him feel, I don't know, almost angelic, if that makes sense.
I love the sequence when he is telling Jane about the story, and instead of like actually watching her while he does it, even though it's a one-way mirror and she can't see him, he turns around and he's mm-hmm. just like, yeah, I can't watch you as I tell this story. Probably because it's just flat out unnerving talking to someone through a one-way mirror, I imagine. But also, like we established that earlier where he doesn't like kind of having these long, drawn-out conversations of, like, potential conflict because he avoids telling his brother and his brother's wife, like, hey, that kid that y'all have been taking care of for the last few years, yeah, he's still mine, and we're going to Houston. It's just like, whoa, okay. And what does he do? He has the kid do it. Like, holy shit. And I get kind of why he has the kid do it, because in some ways it's like, if Travis just calls them up and tells them, they're just going to yell at him. And this is kind of a buffer, but it's also for them to kind of understand, like, hey, the kid wanted me to go with him. Like, the kid wanted me to take him with you, or take him with me. So, like, at least you hear it from the kid's voice, and he's still alive. Like, you know, kind of that kind of situation.
It's the preemptive, let me speak to my son so I know he's still alive when you're talking to a kidnapper.
Yes.
It's like, what if we just had the kid make the phone call? They don't have to ask that, which we know they're going to. It's like, oh, that's a good idea.
Yes.
I think one of my problems is that for the longest time in this movie, we don't know what happened. And that tends to be a problem with me in any narrative form. When, like,
the withholding of information kind of narrative, like
that,
and
that
stuff
essential
like that.
Context that could help me understand why the hell I'm watching this catatonic human being and why people seem to be like dealing with him so well when I'm just thinking about how fucking furious I would be the whole time.
So what was different about something like, correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't Manchester by the Sea not reveal the nature of his depression for at least an hour?
It's like halfway through, something like
it's,
that. Yeah.
It's like halfway through, yeah, but like this movie is like the final 10 minutes. And so I think that like you kind of do, in my mind, you have to give it to me by like the second act, or else
you're out.
All the resolution.
Like, hurry up and share your pain with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It, part of it is like, I'm watching him. He's found his wife and the mother of his child.
Is it the length, Brian? Is it that it's 147 minutes? Are you doing me?
No, because like, even if it were a 15 minute long movie and it took till like the last 3 minutes, like during the climax, for the guy to be like, the reason I've been like this for the past 12 minutes is because I watched my father die of a heroin overdose. I'm like, that's not good enough. It's almost never enough to become part of the climax. Like, I need to know what the trauma is so the emotional resolution for the character lands without me going, like, without me sitting there going like, oh, okay, I'm finally going to learn what this friggin' mystery is. And then that desire for information kind of in my brain overrides what should just be the normal course of things. So Michael, for instance, if Manchester by the Sea had never told us what happened to Casey Affleck's family, and then at the end when his nephew's like, can't you just stay here, and he says, I can't beat it, I can't beat the fact that I burned my family alive, then I would be like, oh well, that's stupid and sucks. But because I know that from the moment
Jesus.
Okay, I'm done.
Okay, great. But because I already know that, I've been able to live in his mind for longer. But like, this guy, I just thought that like he snapped and ran away, and then I find out all this other stuff about him. But it's like, that would have been really great character stuff to know, so that I could be there with him in the victory of being able to speak to his son and to get his son on his side, and then to go on this selfless mission.
But it's not really selfless. He kind of hurts his brother and his wife. Like, I mean, pretty significantly.
I am trying my best not to get hung up on the fact that, like, as far as these two people know, their surrogate son has been kidnapped and is now being sent to live with I don't want to call her a prostitute, but some manner of sex worker in Houston. And can she, you know, can she provide for him? She dumped him with, you know, her brother-in-law and his wife 4 years ago. What's to say she won't just end up doing it again when she realizes that she still is not in a position to take care of this child? Like, what has he really done except to give them the hope for a better tomorrow that they never may be able to actualize? I'm like,
I kind of like that, though. Like, I think he fails.
There's something poetic about it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. Like, I'm willing to let the mystery be, to quote the second season theme song for The Leftovers, in a way that I'm usually not. Like, I'm usually really weighing, like, the morality and, like, what's going to happen. Like I said, at the end of Gone Baby Gone, I had, like, an hour-long conversation with someone about who had the right take on that whole situation. But in this movie, I'm like, I'm willing to let the ambiguity of the situation kind of relax and just be what it is. I'm not thinking about like, why haven't Dean Stockwell and his wife just called the cops and told them that a man who like broke and has been missing for years stole their child. I'm just trying not to think about that because I don't want to nitpick in that way.
I guess for me, like, I honestly wouldn't, I would have been fine not really knowing, like, not knowing those seedy details. Like, I don't know, like, in terms of, you know, I was fine having the context picking up from clues that just something happened to tear this family apart and he went away for a while and now he's sort of wandering back from the wilderness. And yeah, like the uncomfortability of, hey, I want my son back now that I'm better and have processed this a little bit. And the context of the push and pull of, oh, well, we've taken him in. We think he's family now. But yeah, I guess when I watch movies like this, I don't know, maybe it's something about Stockwell's and Harry Dean Stanton's performances that I have that they give me that baseline empathy where I'm like, I don't, it's not so much about like learning the mystery as it is going with this character on this, you know, sort of journey of reconciliation.
I agree. I honestly could have dealt with or without it. The revelation, like it just, I've already made my mind up about Travis at that point in that film. I think you're kind of right in that way, Brian, like that would have given you time to kind of sit with the character. And I don't think this film has a lot of interest in doing that. I think this film just has him kind of delivering that story to Jane to basically apologize to her in a lot of ways and to basically set up that he feels like she belongs with the child, you know?
Again, I'm trying not to get hung up on this, but like...
Get hung up on it if you want to talk about it.
Do we feel like... All right, so yeah, I'm curious. Each of you, how do you read the end of this? Like, are mother and child going to live together happily ever after? Or is the FBI at some point going to swoop in because the school called Dean Stockwell and said, why hasn't your son been at school the last 5 days? And he tells them, my broken brother has taken him to Houston.
I don't know. I guess it doesn't matter to me, I suppose. Like, no. The FBI can come and take them. Yeah, it like for me, the world of the film ends as soon as the credits roll.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's basically it. Like, it kind of reminds me of the end of The Searchers a little bit, where he's accomplished his mission, but he can't go back with them. You know, so he has to ride off into the sunset a little bit. Having sort of accomplished his mission, but not really belonging there because of what he's done and the kind of person he is. So, like, no matter how sort of gentle he's become now, it almost kind of feels like a ghost story a little bit, where he comes back in, has unfinished business, achieves that closure, and then goes away.
Do we mean a general ghost story or the David Lowery film and ghost story?
I'm talking about the scene where Dean Stockwell eats an entire pie for 10 minutes.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Well, to speak to your dissatisfaction a little bit, Brian, like, I think that... Quint, I agree with what you're saying there about the sense of, like, there is a certain sense of, like, almost, like, magical realism to the end of that scene. Like, there is something very, like, purely, like, the pure DNA of, like, the Western in that scene. But I think to also play, like, a little bit devil's advocate and be on Brian's side here a little bit, that is a little bit strange that this film does want to do that dissipation at the end when you consider that there is a good portion of this story that is rooted and grounded in the real world. And like, there is, like, when you think about the first half of this film, it's kind of like the modern world. I don't want to call Harry Dean Stanton's character the old world, but I just want to say, like, like almost a clash of people who live within the bounds of civilization and people live without the bounds of civilization. And that's what the film is kind of about for the first hour. And granted, it's always a character-based story, but like the very virtue or sorry, not the very beginning, the inclusion of Dean Stockwell's character and his wife, played by Aurora Clements, like, those are characters who live in a world where there are consequences, where they, yeah. like, they are living their regular life. So it is, there is something, like, I don't know, there's something very sketch-like and ramshackle about the second half of this movie that I find really fascinating, but, well, like, I could also see it described as really frustrating and, like, incomplete.
Especially with how it's been, I think, Clint, you referred it to, like, as the Searchers in kind of a way, and just mm-hmm. the general Western archetype. In that situation, usually the broken, haunted past gunslinger is the protagonist and the focal point, but he's not the character who has to change. He's usually the person who's there to help someone out. In sort of a Mad Max, Man with No Name kind of way. So mm-hmm. the analogy in my mind breaks down because he's not saving a child from Comanches and bringing him back to his, like, pioneer mother who misses him. He's taking a child from a loving couple and delivering it to the woman who'd previously given him away. And then not sticking around to make sure it's going to work. So, like, the only way I can really square this movie in my mind, even as I try my best not to bring the outer logic of everything that is going to happen after the credits roll, mm-hmm. is to say, like, this is a broken man who is now just broken in a different way and makes another terrible choice and is just going to, once again, walk away without having to deal with the consequences of it.
I feel like we're just missing the epilogue of Paris, Texas, where he was just going out to get groceries and he was coming right back.
he left the parking garage because he had to get into that hotel room.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, when he left, he was like, all right, well, they seem to be doing fine. Now I'm going to go.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, right.
I don't know. It's just a weird thing because, as Michael said, you know, we have what appears to be a two-hander for half of this movie with Harry Dean Stanton mm-hmm. and Dean Stockwell. And then Dean Stockwell and Aurora Clement just kind of disappear. And then we're with Harry Dean Stanton and Hunter Carson. And I don't know. There's a missing narrative element to, like, really fuse all of this together in my mind. And, like, I think that Dean Stanton has, like, just an amazing monologue at the end. And I agree with everything you say about him turning from, like, a silent person to someone who's suddenly, you know, breaking open his heart and pouring the contents onto the floor. But it's just, I feel like there isn't the bridge there. There's not the connecting tissue to make that feel more meaningful. And I think that for me personally, without the sense of, like, what comes next for him or what was really accomplished at all, the movie can't sustain itself in my memory. And I think that's why it, as I've said before, evaporates from my mind, because at the end of the day, I almost feel like, and we learned nothing and nothing was changed, and this narrative can just evaporate like water poured onto the hot macadam of a Texas highway.
Well, for what it's worth, speaking to Dean Stockwell's kind of disappearance from the movie, I remember reading, I think I was reading this today, I think there was, he was supposed to be throughout the whole film. There was, at least at the script level, I think he was sort of following them. He was trying to track them down, try to retrace their steps. And so sort of by the end of the movie, he was going to be in Harry Dean Stanton's kind of position, sort of lost in the wilderness as he loses their trail. And so I don't know the motivations behind, you know, losing that subplot or whatnot. But I think the film still holds up, and I didn't need it to be that. I mean, I think that would have maybe put too fine a point on it, like wrap that up too much in a little bow thematically. I'm not sure. But I mean, it would have been interesting to see that alternate version.
Hmm. Well, do you guys feel like there is, do you think there's anything to the idea that there is it's too clean to say there's two different movies, but I think that I don't know, as I think more about the film, and again, I find this divide really interesting, but I think there is something very different in texture and pacing and tone from that first half to the second half. I mean, whatever we can say about, you know, whether Dean Stockwell, you know, for instance, maybe he just wasn't available for filming or whatever it was. Like, there is something, it's odd to bookend this film with two road trips that feel like they're interested in different things. Maybe I don't know. I'm now, I guess, just trying to stimulate conversation with things I don't totally believe. But I'm just curious whether you guys had any further reaction to the switches between, I guess, the first act and the third act, I guess, specifically.
I will say I appreciate the differences in dynamic between the two. Because like you said, the first road trip is just sort of another journey of, not like discovery. It kind of feels, for lack of a better example, kind of Rain Man-y, where there's the more talkative guy trying to get this other person to open up. And then the second road trip, he's a little more opened up, and so he takes his son with him. But they're both, especially in their interactions, that wonderful montage of them driving down the truck, talking on walkie-talkies, they're both still, like, Harry Dean Stanton is a very childlike character for a lot of it. And so it's interesting to see two childlike characters bounce off each other, like, especially as they're coordinating their plans to surveil Natasha Kinski at the bank and then follow her. And it feels like two kids on a caper a little bit.
Sure, especially since they both fucking fall asleep. Like, nobody is right. Like, hey, you want first watch, or you
which
want
I found really
to?
Charming. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't
yeah,
know.
They're not the best iteration of the Oceans team.
Oceans 2? but I found their dynamic really cute, but not like in a kids movie kind of way. It's not like Cop and a Half. Thank God.
To its detriment, it is not like Cop and a Half.
Yeah, all films should aspire to be like Cop and a Half, including that direct-to-video sequel that had Lou Diamond Phillips in it.
Cop and 3/4.
Oh, God.
Should I know this?
Has Lou Diamond Phillips ever starred in something that isn't directed to
you? And you call yourself a film critic.
La Bamba.
Not knowing Cop and a Half. Yeah. Oh, man.
I feel like we broke Michael.
Maybe. Burt Reynolds and a wisecracking little African-American boy team up to solve crimes.
That's
what Cop and a Half is.
Okay, cool.
Work of cinema. We've broken you further.
It's like Walk Among the Tombstones, but with Burt Reynolds.
Yeah, basically.
For some reason, I'm imagining, like, the gods must be crazy in terms of, like, the characterization of the young boy.
He's more Webster. Yeah. It's like
classic review.
Right. No, it's like Burt Reynolds teaming up with Webster.
Oh, okay.
Like that kind of thing. Like, because you know the way those movies always go. Forget Paris, Texas. We're talking about Cop and a Half now. Now imagine it's the scenario where, like, oh, the kid's a witness to a terrible murder or something. And so he has to stay with this cop. But he's like, oh, quid pro quo. I get to be your partner. And because it's a movie, that happens.
I mean, you know me. I love a movie where, like, someone who shouldn't be a cop has to become a cop for, like, whatever reason. Like, a Castle. Or Lucifer. Yeah. Or most of the shows that are on Fox.
Yeah, most shows are just, like, adaptations of popular movies, but now they're a police procedural. Like, Limitless didn't need to be a police procedural, and now it is. I digress.
Also Lethal Weapon, which exists.
Yes.
Yeah, Lethal Minority Weapon Report. Needs to be a police procedural.
Did we already run out of things to say about Paris, Texas, guys? Are you kidding me?
I mean, I'm the guy who didn't like it that much, and I said it evaporated from my mind. So that should have been a hint to all of you that you needed to step up your game.
Maybe. Like, see, I would feel lucky for this movie to evaporate from my mind, because then I would get to rewatch it for the first time over and over again.
I could accept myself. Welcome to my goldfish life.
That is how Bill and 100% of all mothers view movies.
Yeah.
There's nothing better than sitting down with my mother to watch a movie and her being like, oh, I'd never seen that before. And then, like, 5 minutes before the ending, she's like,
"Yep,
oh, I've seen this.
Yep,
yep, that's me.
That's great."
Well,
I mean, we've talked a lot about theme and story and stuff. Maybe we can talk about like what you guys' impressions were of the aesthetics of the movie, because that's another thing that really appealed to me. Oh, sorry.
I want to mention something that I mentioned on Slack and didn't get any feedback from y'all, so I'll mention sorry. It again.
Passive aggressive Bill.
The music was by Ry Cooder.
Yes.
And apparently he's a famous slide guitarist. And I noticed that the opening tracks for this film and kind of the closing theme sound very, very similar to Breaking Bad's. And I even kind of did some research, and they don't give any credit to Ry Cooder in any form. And I was just, I don't know if y'all heard that same theme and were like, "Oh, that's the theme from Breaking Bad."
I think you heard it because there was a slide guitar, but I didn't hear the same theme at all. Think that I one track I heard, like the opening theme, kind of reminds me of a track from Cowboy Bebop. That's also because the composer for Cowboy Bebop was a noted plagiarist.
Noted plagiarist. That's a really nice way.
Yeah, Yoko Kano. I love her music, but she very clearly was like, "Oh, here's some Western music." Like some of the songs in Cowboy Bebop. Again, another tangent. Like she literally would just take backbeats from other songs and just do them again with different lyrics. They're still good songs, but they came from somewhere.
Interesting. I think Cooter's. You know. I was actually, before Bill mentioned that, I was actually going to say, I think we should talk about Ry Cooder, because I think this score is fantastic. As you guys have mentioned,
I got nothing bad to say about Cooder.
It's so haunting and sort of yearning. And I think they worked together later on Buena Vista Social Club.
Yes,
yes, they did.
Yeah,
yeah. I kind of love that he was in Captain Beefheart, but then he was still also able to make such this like, you know, winsome. Melancholy, but still also kind of sprightly guitar work. Like there's something so like multivalent about the score in this film, and the ways it just, you know, touches on so many different textures and moods.
Just because I don't think we've mentioned it. This is a film. It was written, we said, by Sam Shepard. And for anyone who's curious, yes, that's Sam Shepard. One of our greatest formerly living actors from The Right Stuff.
And greatest playwrights. And I think that's what contributes to the theatricality of a lot of the verbiage.
And that's kind of funny, because like, if you're watching this and you don't know that it's written by Sam Shepard, who is a playwright, I mean, like, it does have a very play-like feel, but it's like a playwright who finally is allowed to, like, stage action and moving cars and like do other stuff, but like he really loves when he can just buckle down and have like some characters sitting around talking, but sometimes the chairs they're sitting in move because they're in a car.
But relative to each other too. And I think that, and I love the way, I think Wenders leans into that theatricality with like the staging and blocking, like especially those scenes in sort of the love motel with the action with the two-way mirrors and the way they move. And, you know, like you said, the turning away from each other and Natasha Kinski like sort of leaning against the other side of the mirror, just sitting down. Like that's very theatrical blocking. Sure. And I think that really leans into, like, that helps it feel sort of a bit magical, realist. Because they're moving with intention.
That shot almost feels like a prototype of like a split diopter, like, you know, like the De Palma signature. Like there's something very like obviously it's organic, but it was kind of weird to see what seemed like a De Palma signature just played completely as something normal.
Well, I mean, and even like that play with lighting, where that one shot where we see Harry Dean Stanton's face in reflection on Natasha Kinski's silhouetted face. So it looks like Harry Dean Stanton has like a blonde wig on. And, you know, very out Lynchian. Of context, that shot looks very silly, but it's very Lynchian. But it really works for me thematically, because that's like their one of their most intimate moments of actual connection. And that was really cool for me.
I love that shot in particular because when we see it from Jane's perspective, we see kind of her view of the one-way mirror, and we start to notice that it's unfinished on that section. That's right. Like it, all we see is just
like insulation.
Like there's no drywall. Insulation, man. I mean, and there's not even drywall there.
It's not dollar operation. You know, they're like, sure, hey, guess what? We can save 40 cents a room on. Not hanging drywall here.
And I love that kind of little detail of that situation because it's something that was, you know, obviously was put thought and effort into from like viewing it from Jane's perspective of how kind of false and faulty that kind of vision is. Not that it ever played as anything more than, you know, a little striptease joint anyways, but it was definitely something that I noticed that they put thought and effort into showing her viewpoint and what her reality has likely been for the last few years, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a wonder. I totally agree with you. It's a really evocative image. And yeah, it's just a really simple way of showing sort of how pathetic her life is or how false those illusions are.
It's also interesting, though, because like I love to like look at a set and the scenery and kind of the fact that paneling is missing there and you can see the insulation. Like, is one of the things that I kind of love. Like, there is a lot of thought behind that. And so that's one of the reasons why, like, even though I'm not 100% on this movie, I'm not, like, trying to eviscerate it. Because there's clearly so much care and attention put into this. And the fact that it doesn't resonate with me may be more something to do with myself than the movie. I love the fact that in that room, in the coffee shop room, the interior lighting for the room appears to be coming from the window. Which means that, like, whoever made these rooms wasn't someone who's just like, yeah, and then we just hang some halogen lamps up top. It's someone who's like, no, we need the lighting effect of putting the light behind this window so it'll look like a real coffee shop. And I just imagine, like, some poor Houston theater production person who's like, yep, I'm going to put that theater tech degree to good use. Putting it in the strip club. Also, I don't know if any of you have been to Houston, but like one of the things that I did love about this movie is it feels like Houston a lot. When they approach Houston and the buildings just kind of rise out of nothing, that's very true to life. But also, Houston has no zoning, so you will see a strip mall that has like a couple of family restaurants and like maybe a furniture store. And then in the pad site closest to the highway in front of that strip mall, there will be a gentleman's club because there's nothing stop it. So like when he's just in the middle of this normal looking place and then he walks into a strip joint, I was like, yep, that's Houston. All right.
Yeah. And we get the, and I love sort of how pathetic the strip joint looks from like right from the get-go, all right down to the really terrible stand-up that's happening in the background, like you know, intentionally terrible stand-up right as he walks over to John Lurie, who has a cameo in this movie. I just really love those little moments. And, you know, even right down to the lighting, I love the way this film is lit, right down to that climax scene that in which changing the lighting changes the tenor of the scene and the dynamic, the power dynamic between the two characters too, I think is really, really cool stuff.
I think something
that's all great
too, as far as the production, just to go back to production design a little bit, I think there's something, there's just as much care put into that. I don't even know what it is. I guess it's an abandoned, it's just an abandoned room that happens to have two couches in it and a vending machine.
Well, it's right next to a laundromat, so it's very clearly kind of set up so, you know, you can put your clothes in the laundromat and then come over here and just fucking kick up your boots, man, because laundry takes a shit ton of time. I don't know if you know that, Michael.
I do know that. I've never had a couch in a laundry I've been to, so I feel like I'm missing out.
Yeah. Well, you should move to small town Texas. I hear you can find some stuff like that.
I might pass on that one.
You don't have the Zips or like anything by you, like one of those places where it's a laundromat, but they also have like a lounge area and an arcade?
No, there are chairs, but I guess we're not as fancy here in Chicago.
Although, look, I've only ever had to do my wash at a laundromat once, and it was one of the worst experiences of my life.
Did someone take out your clothes before you were done, or what happened?
No, so let me see if I remember this correctly. I think it was late at night. My landlord kept saying that he was going to finish like fixing the washer dryer in the house I lived in, and he did not. And so I had gone longer than I'd ever gone before without washing a single stitch of clothing. And I was like, I have to do this tonight. I can't turn another shirt inside out. I was in college at the time, so I didn't give a shit about anything.
Makes
but I was
sense.
Like, I've reached the breaking point. So I loaded up my car with everything I owned, and I went to the laundromat. And it was the night of, I think, the vice presidential debates for the 2008 election. And so it was me and just a bunch of other sad bastards washing our clothes and watching the vice presidents, like, or the potential vice presidents, debate
each
other.
Oh, one of them made it.
Well, yes.
And, are you telling me you weren't comforted by Diamond Joe?
Oh, God. Speaking of Diamond Joe, my
All
wife
right,
is
Leslie,
currently
nope.
actually at a speech that he's given because she's working a booth there. So, hey, nice. That's a good little time capsule for when we're recording this.
Right.
Anyway, so, yeah, I don't know how we got on the subject of laundromats. I feel like the movie is evaporating as we're talking about it. We keep taking these bizarre tangents.
I was going to say something about it, but I want to hear why you had such a bad laundry experience. Just because the vice president.
That was it. Because it was sad.
I mean, no, it was sad. But then, so like, I don't know. You know, obviously, anyone who's listening to this usually probably only knows me through this. So it may seem like I'm the type of guy who likes to talk to people. But I think I've said on this podcast many times before, even if I don't have something to listen to on my phone, I'll keep my headphones in just so people will not speak to me.
Same.
But that night, I had no headphones, and then my phone died, and I didn't have a book with me. And I have, I guess, a youthful face, and like people like, they seem like I'm an interesting person. So all these people who I'd never met, who were like old pros at the laundromat, kept walking up to me and asking me my thoughts on the vice presidential debate.
It's the Cheers of laundromats.
Yeah. And then at some point I go outside, and there's a guy smoking outside, and he's like, you know, what's up? How's it going? And I was like, I'm a student at the university, blah, blah, blah. He's like, oh, what's your field? And I'm like, I'm a journalism major. And he's like, oh, so. And then he launched into like a huge thing asking about my thoughts as a journalist about the presidential debate. He's like, how would you write this up? And I was like, you know what, buddy? I don't fucking know. I need to get out of this laundromat. Why is everyone so fucking talkative in this laundromat?
I just want a cigarette.
And I did the dryer, and I went when it buzzed, and nothing was dry. So I thought that I had some release, but instead I had to do it all over again. And then I got to sit there with everyone as we watched the post-game analysis of the vice presidential debate.
Ah, Jesus.
And I had class in the morning. So yeah, that's my terrible laundromat situation. I never want to go back to a laundromat.
So Paris, Texas.
Back to I want to talk a little bit more about Robbie Mueller's cinematography. Especially the cinematography and Wim Wenders' blocking, because I think that this is really fascinatingly a movie that is about, you know, intimacy being mediated by space constantly. Like you think about early, I mean, obviously that comes through with the car rides, but I think there's almost as much to be said about, you know, the times when he's at his brother's house. And you think about, the thing where you are constantly hearing, you're, for instance, hearing conversations between, why can't I remember Dean Stockwell's character? Jesus Christ.
Walt?
Yes, thank you.
Walt!
Oh, hey.
Sorry.
More Breaking Bad.
Lost. Yeah, no, Lost.
I'm sure someone yells Walt at some point as well in Breaking Bad. But
I just can't. I can't help but think of season two, Lost.
White. People call him Walt all the time.
Right. Yes,
also, Harold Pirineau calls out for Walt.
I think Jesse definitely calls, like, yells Walt's name.
No,
like,
he calls him Mr. White.
Mr. White,
he does call him Mr. White.
Get it right.
He does.
Anyway. Skyler calls him Walt a lot.
I'll let you guys
You
finish.
Were saying, Michael, about cinematography. I totally know what you're saying, because I love the way Harry Dean Stanton is constantly, like, blocked off by mirrors, and even, like, that divide between the stairs and the living room when they're talking to each other about what to do with him, and he overhears. Like, that sense of space is really cool.
Or when Hunter is also hearing a conversation between Walt and his wife. Like, all of those things are so interesting in the fact that, like, when so many of these characters have direct conversations, they don't really say anything to each other. But when there is something separating them, something meaningful comes from it. Like, you can obviously point to the end, but I feel like, I feel like you can point to that lack of intimacy throughout the film.
Absolutely. I think one of the best examples of that, one of my favorite scenes in the film, because I also love the way they use the road, you know, just physically as a visual symbol for stuff. The scene where Travis, having learned how to be a dignified man in his three-piece suit, picking up Hunter from school, they both decide to walk on opposite ends of the street together all the way back home. And it's such a charming scene. And it speaks to that point about they start to develop this intimacy while an entire road is you know, bordering them. And separating them somewhat. And so you see that intimacy despite the space. And I think that's really, really cool.
And see, moments like that, I like really attached to and really liked. It's all the things in between them that kind of like...
It's all that silly talking.
It's all the reality.
Yeah.
I almost wish this movie had been like more whimsical and like almost like, you know, him just walking out of the desert. It's like... That is a magical realism kind of way to start this. And then being found by a German doctor is like a continuation of that. But I kind of wish that, you know, they would have gone to like a hotel and the guy running the hotel would have had like a three-legged dog. And just like...
I think you'd really like Lucky, Brian.
Yeah, I think that I would. I've been meaning to watch that, but...
Yeah, it's a lot more patently whimsical, kind of more on the nose about it, but it's a really fine showcase.
Vimsical.
And David Lynch acts vimsical? In it.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Yes, it's vimsical.
It's vimsical. Yes, you're correct.
Bill.
Appreciate that.
Stop
tip of
the bus. I want to get off.
You want to get off?
Yes.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, man. But another aspect of the cinematography that I think bears discussion or bears mention is the use of color. There's just a wonderful use of color. Like, going back and repeat viewings, you pick up more and more on the significance of the color red throughout the film. From his hat to Jane's car is red, and the shirt and everything. And it just becomes this point of focus throughout the film. And, you know, strong colors are throughout the film, like, those harsh blues of his face as he turns away to tell the story, or the green, just the green light of him as he looks out, you know, looks up at the final shots before heading out in his car. I just love that. I love that kind of cinematography really appeals to me, just the blatant use of color as symbol. Thoughts?
I've only seen it the once, I, so...
Colors are neat, that's my point.
I love the fact that there are colors in this film. That's kind of what I'm saying. Like, when I talk about this movie, there's so much thought, there's so much, like, pure craft put into it that I almost dislike it more for the fact that I don't like it enough for how good it's made.
You're just kind of mad at it for it not making more of an impression on you.
Yeah, it's like if someone made me a meal that had all of the ingredients that I love and I didn't like it, I'd be like furious at them for wasting all those perfectly good ingredients. It's like I made you steak and potatoes, but I ground up the steak and lit it on fire, and this potato has been lightly irradiated, but I've done nothing else to it. And it's like, well, I can't
eat a hamburger
now. Yeah.
Yeah.
What you're saying is you don't like butter on your vegetables? Only oil?
Yeah. What do you think grills are?
But again, you're not, you never want the beef to combust. You want the heat from the grill to grill it for you. You know, I shouldn't have to explain how to cook meat to you.
But you got to get that char.
Just a light char, man. You don't want to let
the sear. It's all about the sear.
This actually brings me to a point that I have been wanting to talk about on this podcast for forever. When you make a s'more, do you let the marshmallow catch on fire?
Yes, just a little bit, and then you immediately
for a
blow
hot
it
second.
Out.
It depends how much of a pyro I'm feeling
for a literal
at that
hot
moment.
Second. Yeah.
God, I hate all of you. Anyway,
so you don't want the black char, is what you're saying?
No, man, you got to get the light toasted brownness. That char is a fucking nightmare.
If it catches on fire, if it catches on fire, I blow it out real quick. But like, I still say mission accomplished.
Anyway, so Paris, Texas.
Paris,
I'm curious.
Texas.
So, you know, Bill, you'd only seen Pena.
The biography of Michael Pena.
Pena? Yeah. The second I said it, I was like, that's not right.
It's actually Pena.
Pena, okay.
Yeah, Pena,
I don't know why I called it Pena, but now I just want to.
Because you're such a big fan of either Michael or Elizabeth Pena.
I would say probably Michael more than Elizabeth, in all honesty.
Wow. Perhaps.
So
she's dynamite in Rush Hour.
Oh yes, just the best.
Yeah.
Michael, were you able to watch any other Wenders movies before we decided to talk about this?
I wasn't. I'm admittedly in the middle of Wings of Desire.
and I'm glad you can admit to that.
Well, I think so. Here's what I can say briefly about it, having seen the first
Wings.
Hour. Things of bizarre. Oh boy. I think that, you know, it is really interesting. I can't even remember who used the word angelic for Harry Dean Stanton, but there is something. You know, I know Wings.
Whimsical.
Vinsome.
I know Wings of Desire obviously has a reputation of, you know, being a film about omniscience. But having seen, you know, at least part of that film and comparing it with the visual and tonal sense of Paris, Texas, like there's something, there's a really fascinating, again, like a meditation between that almost like third and first person that I think this film kind of gets into too. Like, you know, going back to the way that spaces feel, I think there are moments where you are, you know, even as you're ostensibly following Travis for basically the whole film, like there is a sense at any point that this movie could just like drift off into the landscape, like in the same way as something like Margaret. Like there's something that's not quite omniscient, but is unfixed, which I also find really compelling and I guess strange to go back to that word.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's another question. I mean, if some of us have seen Wings of Desire, but you know, have we seen the far superior American remake City of Angels? And how do we feel that City of Angels stacks up thematically with Paris, Texas?
I've heard that
there
song
are fewer
a lot.
Cage freakouts, yeah.
Oh, man.
I think I only saw half of City of Angels once on like TBS when I was a kid.
Really?
Yeah.
I feel like I've oddly enough seen that movie like four times, but I can't remember the context around any of my viewings.
Yeah. I just know Meg Ryan's in it. That's all.
And then Sipowicz is in it too.
Who?
I don't remember his name. The guy from NYPD Blue.
Oh, Dennis Franz.
Yes.
Yes. Blowout's Dennis Franz.
Even by our usual standards, wow. This is tangential.
Yeah, perhaps. Perhaps.
Yeah, we're having trouble.
Well, does anybody else have anything to say?
We're just binging it right at this point.
Yeah, we've thrown caution to the wind, and we're just letting it go. I blame some of my punchiness on the fact that this is the third podcast that I have done in as many days.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yes.
What are we doing?
we've stopped caring about our well-being, mental, physical, and psychological.
My girlfriend was like, "You're doing a podcast again?" And I was like, "Yeah, this is not usual."
Right.
Fucking Cloverfield. Jesus.
They just had to go and do it, didn't they?
They done did it.
Uh-huh. It's there.
Wow.
Yeah. It's real.
What was I going to say? So we've been talking for an hour and 15 minutes, and maybe 38 minutes of that has been Paris, Texas. So let's wrap up with some final thoughts. I guess, Michael, you decided to see other Wim Wenders movies following your viewing of this movie. Is that the type of thing, like, if you had just seen this kind of in a vacuum, do you feel like this would have made you go out and look for his other films if we weren't talking about it and you wanted context?
Maybe. I mean, I'll admit, when I watched this about 6 months ago, I don't think I got nearly as much out of it. I Brian, I probably had more similar to your reaction. It was the second viewing, though, that, I don't know, brought it into focus. Well, it's not really a focus movie. It cleared up more of what I was seeing in the movie the first time. I guess that's the best way to put it. And now I especially want to see more. I will say that our benevolent overlord, Jordan Rupp, recommended that I watch This American Friend. So I probably will watch that one because I've heard bizarre things about that. And a fun connection, Natasha Kinski, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Her father,
I think it's Klaus Kinski's daughter, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And Klaus Kinski, I think, stars in This American Friend, actually.
Hmm. By the way, we never mentioned how good she is in this. Like, with her brief scenes in this, I think she gives a wonderful performance, especially even just listening, just hearing his monologue. She's doing so much in that close-up. That it's just it should not be overlooked.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of funny, as like a couple that spends 90% of their screen time in silence. Her and Dean Stanton are like super well cast in their ability to give you a lot just through like their eyes and their gazes into an uncertain distance and before them.
I feel like there's no better distillation for that than the Super 8 footage we watch, which is like, you know, nothing short of devastating. You know, obviously seeing them and Harry Dean Stanton's like just performance watching that is fantastic, as his eyes kind of move slowly back and forth between Hunter watching it and him watching it and like remembering that moment and then also realizing his guilt. Like the whole like arc of emotion in that scene. Again, not to take it away from Natasha Kinski, but I realize I did just want to mention that.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. I think Harry Dean Stanton's got one of the most fascinating faces in cinema, too. He's just, even when he's doing nothing, you get volumes of emotional and thematic and cinematic information from him. And so it's just, that just sort of speaks to his majesty as an actor, and also just the ability for good directors to highlight that look that he has and elevate it to something more.
And I'm also, I would say Dean Stockwell, too, is very well cast in this.
Harry Dean Stockwell?
Yeah, exactly. He, I don't know which one, but I feel like he is a Simpsons character come to life, especially in this movie, but I can't pinpoint which one. Like, it definitely wouldn't be Homer or anyone, but it would be like a third tier, you know, like maybe Carl or Lenny.
Yeah, maybe. I just imagined that this was just like a Quantum Leap episode, and Harry Dean Stanton was just Sam, and so Al had to like help him achieve his mission of reuniting Harry Dean Stanton with his son, and that way he could leap home.
Absolutely, 100%.
Like when we're not looking, he like pulls the little Ziggy out and starts like, you know, hitting buttons.
I think that's a good way to end.
I was about to say, you're really committing to this bit, aren't you?
Yes. 100%.
It's almost like you belong on this podcast.
Just I know. I'm
trying way too hard to make something funny when it's clearly not working. Was Dean Stockwell, he was in Battlestar Galactica too, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was like the head Cylon. And he was fun in that too.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway.
And Dean Stockwell, while we're on the subject, he started out as a child actor. And so I remember reading he would like give Hunter Carson tips on how to sort of navigate being on a film set too, which was really, really cool. And I think one thing he told him was, one thing you're going to hear all the time is, oh, that was great, one more time. And so, just to prepare him for like having to do a bunch of takes. And he's like, I want to go back to playing. I know, just one more take. So I just thought that was fun.
Yeah, a director is like the personal trainer of the film world. Great, good work. Just one more time. Okay, Perfect. Now one more time. Anyone else? Final thoughts before we wrap up for the time being?
I talked a lot. I'm good.
Right. Bill Graham?
I'm good.
All right, great. I wish I had more stories about laundromats, but like I said, I only had that one. So I, too, am out of things to say. So we can bid our listeners a fair adieu. We don't know what our next classic review is going to be, nor who our guest will be, but check out Twitter at Film Stage Show, where we'll eventually post the poll so that you fine people can help us decide what to watch. And yeah.
What to watch.
Yes, what to watch.
Okay. We're all just Dracula. I'm committed to turning you into Dracula.
Yeah, every Germanic language is a Dracula language. That's
right. That's the essential lesson we've learned today.
Absolutely. Anyway, go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow and help us to create more excellent episodes like the one you
definitely
just
definitely.
As little as $1 an episode. And of course, you can always give more. You can give more if you want to. We're not going to stop you. Again, that's patreon.com/filmstageshow. Go to movie.com/filmstage to get some of the best cinema available online. Again, a rotating 30-film catalog for you to enjoy, whether you want to download it or watch it streaming on your smart TV or your laptop or your PC, if you're one of those weird people who still has a tower. I don't know what's wrong with you. Go to mubi.com/filmstage for a free 30-day trial so that you can understand the wonder that is MUBI. And I think that's about it. That's all we got. So, guys, let's tell the fine people at home where we all can be found either between now and the next time, or in the case of Clint Worthington, just from here on out. So let's start with Bill Graham.
Cool. You can find me sitting down to watch anything but a movie tonight on Twitter at CableBFG. You can also find me on that Slack channel, Patreon. Give us your money.
Yes, and we are going to figure out how big that monster is.
Yes.
By the way, game changer, someone in the Slack channel
asked
the question while we were recording, can Clovey fly? Which, if he can, whoa, how are we even going to keep up with this? Just don't know. Anyway, Clint Worthington.
You can find me on Twitter at AlcoHollywood. I also run the podcast AlcoHollywood, which you can find at AlcoHollywood.com. Nathan Raven's Happy Cast, which you can find at NathanRaven.com. And TV Party, which you can find at ConsequenceOfSound.net, where I also do film and TV writing.
All right, Michael Snydell.
You can find me taking a well-needed rest from all of these podcasts that we're recording on Twitter at Snydell, and I'm also on Letterboxd, and that's good for right now.
Okay. You can find me on my personal site, dearfilm.net. You can find my writing and more podcasts at thefilmstage.com, and you can harass me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan, Letterboxd, same. Other than that, thanks for sticking with us. If you have listened to each of these three episodes that we've created in the last 3 days on the day that they dropped, have a cookie. I'm not going to give you one, but I am giving you permission to have one. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. and tune in next time. Pas de bonheur dont je connais la cause.